Rural Focus.
Hello, how you all going? Hope you're having another wonderful day wherever you could be around the great world that is. It is Troy Stockton aboard. Yes, here we go with another Rural Focus podcast. If it's happening in agricultural or horticultural circles, we do our best to bring it to you, and that we most certainly will today. And coming your way, it's a massive day for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. They're celebrating a very special birthday. We're going to catch up with one of the Flying Doctor pilots in James Anderson. He's going to come on very soon and speak about what today means for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. Also, not too far away, we'll catch up with Josh from the Condinan Group, and also too, we'll catch up with Craig Walker from Nutrient. How did the other day's Mushay cattle sale go? We'll find out very soon from the one and only Craig Walker. But right now, time to fizz things up just a little bit, but probably not in the way that you're thinking. It's time right now to say hello to Joe from GRDC. Joe, hello there to you.
Good morning, Troy.
Fizz test, what are we speaking here?
We're trying to help growers, mainly in the eastern wheat belt of WA, at on-farm lime resources. And we've come up with a few different things that we've looked at some technologies to try and find and identify those on-farm lime sources.
Reading through a report that's out, around about 70% of soils around the southwest of WA have shown through regular surveys to be very acidic?
That's correct. Yep. So agriculture tends to make, in the western area anyway, tends to make soils more acidic, and we're requiring on lime sources to help rectify that acidity. So growers in the eastern wheat belt actually find it very difficult because all the lime in WA is located on the coast, and transporting the lime inland is the most expensive part of the actual operation. So a lot of growers actually have found some online lime sources on their farms, and we would like to help them by identifying some of those as well. And we've come up with a new, it's not really a new technique.
Yeah.
It's been known in the labs for a while.
Yep.
But, we're trying to create some statistical rigour and some more information around how to actually conduct a fizz test on farm. And we're helping growers to actually lower their costs and while they're trying to identify their lime sources.
So what do the growers need to do here then, Joe?
Well, at the moment, we're looking to increase our actual our data set, and to help, as I said, get more statistical rigor around the things.
Mm.
So I'm looking for actual 60 more samples to be sent to the GHD office in Geraldton.
Yep.
And the growers, as part of that, will actually help create that statistical rigor for the fizz test, and they'll get their lab data as well from their samples. So it's a real win-win. We get to help them make a better, cheaper option, like a quicker test on farm, and the ones that participate in helping us do that get the lab survey, lab data as well from their samples.
So you're wanting 60 grower soil samples, is that what you're after?
That's right. We're looking for 60 growers or 60 soil samples to help us create a better data set.
Have you had any in at the moment yet, Jo?
So the first year of the project, we took 20 samples from out in the eastern wheat belt, so from up to Muckambuddin right down to Mount Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And those growers have got all their data as well, and that's how we actually came up with the idea.
Okay.
So the technology that we looked at, we were hoping to get a point and shoot and hope like we could get some really off-the-shelf mining technology.
Yep.
The only trouble is that's quite difficult.
Okay.
We found technologies that would work, but it's not quick and they're not cheap to buy, and it requires further data analysis post the actual quick bit of the application. So the fizz test we've come up with as the best way to make this quick on-farm activity for growers.
Now, I also believe there's a demonstration video out for our growers, so where can they find that?
So GRDC YouTube channel has the fizz test now, and as more information comes out from this project, it'll all be going up onto the GRDC website as well. So
are you more or less trying to find out who's using lime in their soils in a way? Is that what you're trying to find out?
Well, most growers are using lime, and so we're actually trying to assist growers in the eastern wheat belt in particular that have on-farm lime sources. So there are these calcareous soils within the Eastern Wheat Belt. It's a very strange geological event that happened out there. And so they actually do have quite alkaline soils. And it's usually linked to morel, where the morel trees grow.
Okay.
So if growers do have those sorts of soils, we're interested in finding out whether or not their samples are would be very good. I mean, it's an economic for them to actually, if they would like to dig up their soils and apply them. But it's only economic if their actual pH is high enough to actually make a difference to the other land around it.
All right. So best to get in contact with you at GRDC today.
That'd be absolutely great if people could do that.
All right. So we're after 60 grower samples of soils containing carbonates for further tests. So, come on, growers around regional WA, this is your chance to have your say on what is on your farm and everything else. So 60 samples of soils. Get in contact with Joe at GRDC there today. What's the best contact there for you, Joe?
9230-4600.
Go ahead and do that. Hey, good luck with the fizz test.
Great. Thanks so much, Troy.
The following interview on the Rural Focus podcast is a paid interview. A reminder, this may not be the right product for you and other goods and services may be available.
Tom, what early catch up with our man in the Midwest, Craig Walker from Nutrient. Morning, sir.
Good morning, Troy. How are you, buddy?
Not bad, not bad. Let's get it out of the way. I heard Muirchead, not a great day there yesterday, mate, unfortunately.
It wasn't its finest moment, you might want to put it down. There was a bit of a slip in the market in some categories that came through, but we did see some local steers that are 200 to 300 kilos live weight. They sold from $4.20 to $5. We did see some pastoral steers, similar sort of weight, 300 to 400 kilos. They sold from up to $3.40, and heavier steers sold up to $4.90. They were a little bit softer. The biggest one that was hit was our pastoral heifers, and even though it is a bit of a tough gig at the moment with those, and it's all quality dependent, some really good quality cattle bought around $3 a kilo, and some lighter weights sold as low as about $2 a kilo. But what it does actually represent is some very, very good buying opportunities for people. So as much as if you're a seller, not the best, but as a buyer, I should have... that coffee was a bit hot. But as a buyer, you've got great opportunity there to get some of these cattle and tuck them away. I know they'll take a little bit longer to fatten up and freshen up. Yeah, if you sit on them with the way the season has and the good rains that are coming and the way it's sort of shaping up, everyone, there is an opportunity there to tuck these cattle away, even if there's only 50 or 40 or, you want to buy 100 odd. You just put them into a paddock. They're not very heavy. They're in that 200 kilo weight range, 2 to 250. So, they're not going to eat a great deal of grass. And, I know it's going to get cold, but, we're looking at the fact that these cattle are, they represent good buying. And towards the back end of the year, we really should see some positive growth there in that market. So, maybe that's something to look at. In the cow market, we saw a slight slip there due to a few issues with processing. We saw big, heavy cows. They sold to a top of just under $3 at $2.92. Medium cows, they sold from $2.70 to $2.86. And lightweight cows actually held firm at $2.20 to $2.70. So the cow market was still pretty buoyant in it. And, as I say, we are coming into the beginning of the season with the North, with some people looking at mustering and some people moving on, and a few issues still with COVID and processing, as we're seeing in the lamb industry at the moment. So, it's an interesting time, and I don't think we definitely haven't seen COVID before, only in the last 2 years, but we've sort of seen a bit of a different market. Yeah, we're working through it.
So that's what happened out at Muirchead yesterday. Any talk on what could happen with live exports, mate?
Well, no, it's still up in the air, mate. It still depends on what's going to happen with the federal election. And we've seen the announcement where Labor's going to phase it out. We don't know over what time frame or how quickly. They sort of indicated some reports saying 2 years and so forth, but we don't really know. And one of the things that sort of frustrated me is the opposition leader and probably a Minister for Agriculture as well. And this is only a Craig Walker opinion, mind you, not a Nutrient opinion. This is only my opinion, but and I want to make that perfectly clear. It's just people are saying that the demand's fallen off and fallen off. And, Yeah, the supply did fall off because a number of years ago, the eastern states, if we remember, in terrible drought, you know, they had they came off the back of massive sell-off and they had no stock. So the demand was huge. And we saw millions of, you know, for a couple of years there was a couple of million sheep go to the eastern states. And as a result of that, a lot of them were lambs. And because we were dry in WA, they were green. So they were coming over here and buying lightweight lambs and sending them across. That had a negative impact upon live export and actually had less sheep available for live export and for domestic processing. So there was a knock-on effect there. So I think that the information that they're using is actually false economy, because there was a lot of sheep actually left the state and went to the eastern states for processing. And if you have a look, you know, I'm an advocate for live export and I'm an advocate for animal welfare and making sure that everything's done properly. But the biggest issue that we have got is that if we look at Western Australia, WA is one of the most remote cities in the world. And if we are in New South Wales and we're selling lambs, and you see it in Wagga and you see it in Tamworth and you see sales in Victoria and South Australia, they all within 400 kilometres to 1,000 kilometres, they have got multiple meatworks. Mm. All right, they've got multiple competition that goes in the sale yard, so they can actually handle, and they've also got a sheer bigger volume and a bigger export market into international markets. Western Australia, the guys over here have done an amazing job to develop markets that they've done, but we've actually got a really, really small pool. And now with the price of diesel to get the taxi ride across the border has probably gone up quite considerably by about, almost $10 a head. Mm. It's almost taking the eastern states out of the marketplace. So what we're seeing is that we're going to have a feast or a famine in Western Australia, and that's what we're trying to avoid. And that is where live export actually comes into play. It actually assists our market to make sure that it's stable and it can handle the oversupply when it comes. So, it is an integral part of what our business does. It'd be like someone who only sells oranges, but you can't sell it you can only sell it through your two major outlets, Coles and Woolies. That's it. You can't sell them anywhere else, and they can only go for juicing. You can't eat them. You can only put them in juicing. So that's the scenario that we're looking at the moment without live export. And, and it means that there's got to be a lot of work on it. And then if we're looking at everyone getting a pay rise, as the Labor Party are saying, and I'm not being political, but then all of a sudden there's more costs in WA, so our lamb is dearer again. Yeah. So someone's got to pay for it, and will people pay for it? So I don't know. I'm really a little bit concerned over some of the policies that have been made on the run to appease minority groups that are around the place. And I know that there's going to be some blowback over my comments, but they are Craig Walker's personal opinion, not Nutrien's opinion.
All right. It's going to be interesting to see what does happen, more or less, I would say, this time next week. Nice to chat. Enjoy your week. We'll chat again next week.
Look forward to it, mate. I'll tie my high horse up and give him a feed and a drink and get off him and leave him alone for a while, eh?
Rural Focus on Triple M.
Well, it's a massive day today for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. I won't give it away, but I'll let Flying Doctor James Anderson explain all about it. Dr. James, good morning there to you.
Morning, Troy. Thank you very much for having us on.
Big day today. What is the big occasion today for the Royal Flying Doctor Service?
Well, it's our 94th birthday today, so it's Flying Doctor Day today. And 94 years ago, the first RFDS flight took off. And so we're celebrating that today, trying to raise a bit of awareness of the service we provide and asking the community for their support.
So how can people support the RFDS for today, Flying Doctor Day?
Well, we are really lucky that the community gets behind us every day of the year so that we can help support people in the country areas. If they go to flyingdoctorday.com.au, they can make a donation today. We're trying to raise $600,000 for new medical equipment. And every donation that's been donated by the community is being matched by our giving partners, who are Rio Tinto, CBH Group, IGO, and Burncut.
Fantastic. So hopefully a big day today. Dr. James, just how important is community support for the Royal Flying Doctor Service?
It's really important. I think the people who live and spend a bit of time in the country and regional areas know how much of a lifeline the RFDS is for the community out there. And whilst we do receive some government funding, we need extra support from the community to help be able to deliver the kind of service that the country people need. And it's everything from, medical equipment that needs to be turned over or replaced to, obviously that's what we're aimed to focus on today is, new and improved equipment for the crews and the aircraft.
Yeah, certainly. And how long have you been with the Royal Flying Doctor Service for?
I've been at RFDS for 5 years now.
Okay.
And it's been a good ride.
Do you have a memorable retrieval somewhere?
Oh, there's lots of interesting stories. Yeah. One that comes to mind that was a little challenging was a chap who got a circular saw wedged in his flank, in his side of his abdomen. And when you get something like that, stuck in somebody's someone's guts, the rule number one is don't ever remove it until you're kind of near an operating theatre. And
wow.
The only problem we had is we couldn't get the patient in the aircraft with that thing attached to him. So that was that's the kind of difficult situations we get into where, it's important to move a patient and care for them, but you have to make decisions and do interventions that we might not normally do in a city hospital where there's more resources and capacity. So that was interesting. We had to take the circular saw out, and the patient did very well. But, you have all sorts of strange things that patients in the country seem to come across from time to time.
What qualifications and, say, skills and attributes does it take to become a flying doctor?
So we've got a broad variety of doctors who work for us. All of them have some critical care medicine experience, whether that's emergency medicine, intensive care medicine, or anaesthesia. But we also need doctors who have a bit of an understanding of rural medicine and sort of primary health care as well that might happen out in small clinics out in the bush. Because we do things, everything from teleconsults for somebody on a station who has a kid who's a bit sick, all the way through to delivering intensive care type services for critically unwell patients who need to be moved to the city. So it's quite a generalist bunch of skills.
So what type of, say, aircraft types have you trained to deliver care in?
We've got three groups of aircraft. So we've got our workhorse, which is the PC-24, which is a turboprop aircraft with a propeller up the front. We've got 17 of those. We've got three jets, the Rio Tinto Life Flight PC-24 jets. They're really good for going long distances, so up to the Kimberley and back. And we can take three stretchered patients on the jet as opposed to the turboprop aircraft where we can only take two. And we've just, in the last week or two, started operating our two EC-145 helicopters, which are working more in the range sort of within 250 kilometres of Perth to try and get those patients in those, kind of nearby hospitals to the city quickly when there's a sort of time-critical situation.
And Dr. James, what's it like, say, delivering care inside the RFDS is flying ICU in the sky rather than, you're on land there in a hospital somewhere?
Yeah, so they're pretty cramped spaces, but we try and set up all the gear and equipment so that we can do, a variety of, emergency and intensive care type interventions and care in the aircraft. So, it's fun. It's one of the best parts of the job is, when you're flying out somewhere that you get to look out the window and see this amazing country that we fly over. I always say to the people when they're coming in, you're either going to go fly somewhere interesting, do something clinically interesting, or you'll just meet a lovely patient who's, incredibly appreciative of the care that they're getting and the service that they're receiving.
All right. So it's happy birthday today to the Royal Flying Doctor Service, the 94th anniversary. Believe it or not. So today, Flying Doctor Day. So if somebody wants to make a donation today, Dr. James, what's the best way that they can go about that?
Yeah, so they can go to flyingdoctorday.com.au, or if they're after some Flying Doctor socks, which are quite comfortable and warm, head over to our normal website, the RFD, which is rfdswa.com.au.
And I believe some WA landmarks will be lit up both blue and red later on tonight too. So maybe you're doing that in your part of WA. So, fantastic.
All over the state.
Hey, Dr. James, thanks for your time today. Go well today. And, let's see if we can raise plenty of money for you and the team there at the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Troy. And thanks to the community for their support.
The following interview on the Rural Focus podcast is a paid interview. A reminder, this may not be the right product for you and other goods and services may be available.
Time right now to catch up with one of the lads from the Condinan Group. It's Josh's turn this week. Good morning, mate.
Good morning, Troy.
What have you been up to, mate?
Mate, I've been out and about looking at sheds, to tell you the truth.
Sheds?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm guessing it's not your little garden shed.
No. We'll leave the garden sheds to another day. So, these are large on-farm sheds that we've been looking at. So,
oh, okay.
It's been a pretty interesting project.
Do I ask Why?
Yeah, well, I suppose there's been probably a fair bit of interest in on-farm infrastructure lately, probably for a few reasons. I mean, certainly, you know, here in WA, Cyclone Seroja created a lot of demand for sheds, and certainly people were probably thinking in terms of updating or correcting or, you know, improving what they had if they're going to do a new build. I also think there's, we've talked about this amongst the fellows, we reckon there's a little bit of a COVID effect as well. So I think that tends to, you know, make people want to improve infrastructure or get some projects sorted. Certainly I built a shed during the first lockdown. And look, I think also, you know, in the case of fertiliser sheds, a bit of fertiliser security.
Okay.
So
yep.
One of the more common things we've seen going in is fertiliser storage sheds, whether they be just plain fert sheds or a dual purpose fert and bulk grain storage. So yeah, we've certainly seen a fair few new fertiliser shed builds while we've been out there travelling around.
Mate, do you find that the sheds are getting bigger and bigger year by year?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Some things we've seen are just utterly enormous. And even the height of some of the sheds I mean, you know, fair enough in a fert shed where you might want to tip a truck. But some of the machinery sheds that we've seen, we were talking to a farmer the other day, and he said, well, this shed was so massive. You know, he was removing the engine out of a harvester and he was able to use the excavator inside the shed to sling the engine out. So, you know, all without coming anywhere near the roof. Yeah, so look, they are bigger, and I suppose machinery is bigger, and we have more of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we need bigger sheds.
Certainly do. Yeah, you're going to need a bigger shed. Mate, what are some of the challenges, say, building or putting up a shed these days?
Well, I think a lot of the challenges come before you even get to that point.
Okay.
Steel is hard to get, and in a lot of cases, price of steel has almost doubled for some things. So, you know, that adds a huge amount to the cost of a shed, which is mainly all steel. And, you know, we've talked to some farmers who have been trying to get new sheds built for ages, and they've said some situations the waiting list is 2 years. Other situations, you know, they're not getting callbacks from shed builders.
Yeah.
Their books are that full. So, those challenges are quite intense. And, I suppose leads to a lot of forward planning, you know, if you do want a shed down the track.
Well, do you just go and do it yourself?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, given the size and the complexity of some of these structures, I certainly wouldn't want to embark on it, especially given that I'm not particularly fond of heights. I get about 4 metres off the ground and that's it.
Yeah. 4 metres more than me, mate. But anyway, what other research is happening there with you and the team of the Condon Group there, mate?
Yeah, so look, so that is June's research report.
Okay.
And then we're just about to also do some spreader testing. So
this is
not an across-the-board test. This is we're looking primarily in AgriSpread and a Marshall, and we're going to test the effect of lime curtains on these machines.
Mm.
So like to get a good bit of concrete research out there as to the effectiveness of lime curtains. So that's going to be quite interesting. And then September, it's time for grain storage. So believe Ben White, our grain storage expert, is going to travel around and do a whole lot of testing on new grain silos. So a bit more focus on infrastructure there.
All right. So that's to come throughout 2022. So, there you go. There, if people want to know more or they want to find out more with you and the team there at the Condon Group, mate, is there a website that they can check out?
Yeah, absolutely. farmingahead.com.au, and that will point you to the articles, or otherwise, if you're getting the magazine, just check it out. And you can. There's also an option through the website to get a free trial of the magazine.
I'll let you go and work on another shed. Mate, thanks for your time this morning.
My pleasure, Troy.
And there you have it, another Rural Focus podcast here on the Listener app. Hey, thank you for joining us. Where are you listening to the podcast from? WA? Somewhere over east? Somewhere internationally? Love to hear from you. Jump onto the Rural Focus Facebook page and let us know, or maybe even jump on to the Twitter page as well. Yes, we're now on Twitter, Rural Focus. It's at @rural_focus. That's our Twitter page. Maybe you can leave us a message there. I've been Troy Stockton, and I look forward to bringing you another Rural Focus podcast here on the Listener app again very soon.